Hello and welcome to the EMG Health Podcast with me, your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia. I've previously said that doing this podcast gives me the opportunity, the privilege to talk to some amazing people and to share those conversations with you. Sometimes it's a new friend, sometimes old. And this time it's a chap who I met many, many moons ago. Professor Jeff Ponsky and I first met at a course I was teaching on laparoscopic cholecystectomy. And during that time, we became fast friends. But over the years, Jeff has taught me so much more than I could have imagined about surgery, about the politics of medicine, about how to best comport oneself, about life. Dr. Ponsky is a graduate of Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine and completed his surgical training at University Hospitals of Cleveland. He then joined the faculty of the Department of Surgery at University Hospitals in Cleveland, where he was the director of surgical endoscopy. And in 1979, he became the director of the Department of Surgery at the Mount Sinai Medical Center in Cleveland, where he remained through 1997. And during his tenure there, he earned his executive MBA from Case Western's Weatherhead School of Management. During that time, Jeff was professor of surgery at Case Western Reserve University and vice chairman of the Department of Surgery at Case. And then he moved across town to the Cleveland Clinic, I think you might have heard of that, as the director of endoscopic surgery and was the first executive director of the Minimally Invasive Surgery Center. He was also the vice chairman of the Division of Education and director of graduate medical education. He served as a member of the Board of Governors at the Cleveland Clinic. By the way, I'm giving you all this background just to let you know what an accomplished bloke Jeff is. In 2005, he assumed the Oliver H. Payne Professorship and Chair of the Department of Surgery at Case Western School of Medicine. And Dr. Ponsky also served as Surgeon-in-Chief at that institution and returned to the Cleveland Clinic. He was bouncing backwards and forwards across Cleveland to concentrate on the practice of foregut surgery and advanced surgical endoscopy. Jeff has served as president of the Society of American Gastrointestinal Endoscopic Surgeons, or SAGES, an organization I was very, very proud to be involved with. He's been president of the Ohio chapter of the American College of Surgeons, president of the Cleveland Surgical Society, president of the American Society for Gastrointestinal Endoscopy, and he's a fellow of the American College of Surgeons and a member of numerous prominent medical and surgical societies. And he was the chairman of the American Board of Surgery. I could go on and on and on. Jeff has received countless awards, including the George Bursey Lifetime Achievement Award. And for those of you who know who Dr. George Bursey is, that's one heck of an honor. And not surprisingly, Jeff was listed in the best doctors in America each year since that list was developed. Jeff has published over 300 original articles and book chapters, authored or edited 6 textbooks, and serves on the editorial boards of numerous journals. He's an inventor and an innovator. More of that later. And in 2009, the Jeffrey L. Ponsky MD Chair in Surgical Education was established at Case. All, of course, in Jeff's honor. In 2017, Dr. Ponsky was appointed the initial holder of the Linda and Marlin Yonker Chair in Developmental Endoscopy, and he presently serves as Emeritus Professor of Surgery at Case. He tells me that he's planning on retiring soon. I don't think surgery can afford for him to retire. When Jeff has not been pushing the boundaries of the possible in medicine, he's a devoted family man, and he's got a wonderful family, and he's also been an accomplished equestrian. And the sight of him riding into the ballroom of a major surgical medical meeting gala dressed as a cowboy atop a rather considerable horse is an image that will stay with me forever. All I can say is, wow, Professor Jeff Ponsky, welcome.
Thanks, Jonathan, for a wonderful introduction. It has me laughing.
Well, I have to tell you, normally I truncate these things just to a few sentences. But, it, you know, knowing you for these many years and considering you a dear friend, for someone to have achieved what you've achieved and to remain so sweet, so charming, so humble is really a mark of the man you are. You've had and are having an amazing career. You excel at everything you do, looking after patients, teaching, writing, research, administration. Which of those activities do you love the most, and what drives Jeff Ponsky?
Well, it's a difficult question to answer. I love all of those things. I think when you reflect on the different activities, the one that is the most rewarding is teaching. And if you look at your life's activities and what you've been able to contribute, I think to spread your knowledge throughout all the people you know and you've trained is probably the greatest gift and the most rewarding.
Yeah, I would agree. You know, teaching someone and seeing them flourish and, well, in my case, do better than me always made me very, very happy. I mentioned innovation in the introduction. You've had many, and among your many innovations, you invented the percutaneous endoscopic gastrostomy technique and kit, the PEG. And every time I put one in, I thought of you. Although most of our audience are doctors, of course, not all are. So please, Jeff, can you first of all explain what the device is and what led you to the idea?
Well, let me go into it this way. In the early days of flexible endoscopy, where we put tubes into the mouth or the rectum, the instruments were new and the techniques were very, very basic. And as a surgeon doing this, we were always standing back and looking at what we were doing and say, how can we do something else with this? How can we combine surgical technique with endoscopic procedures? And so back in the 1970s, I was doing flexible endoscopy at University Hospital of Cleveland. And I did most of the endoscopy in very little babies because we didn't have pediatric gastroenterologists then. I worked with a pediatric surgeon very closely. His name was Michael Gauder. And Michael and I and his chairman, Dr. Eisant, who was a great supporter of mine, would do endoscopy in these little babies for various reasons. And we would note that in the small babies, when we put the scope in the abdomen in a dark room, we could see the light shining through the abdominal wall. We would actually touch it with our finger and see the stomach indent. Dr. Gauder was extremely intuitive and extremely innovative, and he had been looking for a way to reduce the morbidity of a gastrostomy in these mentally disabled babies for a long time. We got together and thought of some ideas, and we put those ideas to use in these babies who had birth asphyxia, and we came up with the idea of putting the needle through the abdominal wall to grab a string and drag the tube into the stomach. We had talked to the parents and said, look, if this doesn't work, we'll then have to open the abdomen and do a routine surgery gastrostomy instead. It did work, and so we were able to go forward with that. These days, we would have to do much more groundwork first, including IRB, Institutional Review Board approval, before we did the procedure.
Yeah, the early days of innovation in surgery certainly were less highly regulated. And just for the benefit of those people who are not doctors listening in, that does not mean people were cowboys, even though you look like one on a horse. I think that people like you, Jeff, were very, very cautious and diligent and were doing things to try and improve the care of patients and do, primum non nocere, firstly do no harm. So I just wanted to make that point. So, Jeff, you know, it's one thing to have had an idea, like you described the development of the PEG technique. Making it real is quite another. And you've done a great job working with various medical device companies. And in an era where some people frown at clinicians who collaborate with companies, you've been an example of how to do it right. I'm personally a huge fan of such liaisons, but I know others are not. And I'm very worried that political correctness is going to impair our ability to put engineers, business people, and innovators in medicine and surgery in the same room. I'm going to ask you to wax lyrical about this.
Well, I was so privileged to work with so many wonderful people in the medical device area in that early era. And they would come into the laboratory with me, and we would look at this problem together. My perspective as a clinician and their perspective as an engineer. And we would talk about the problem and come up with solutions together and then test them in the laboratory very carefully over and over and over again. And we tested these PEG tubes After we came up with the idea and showed that it could be done, we actually worked very hard with industry in the laboratory to produce a good, reliable, and safe tube. And then it was marketed. And I have to tell you, the financial gain from these was not large. And we were able to do this with very good ethical control. I have to say that there is always the worry that industry could become overwhelming. I think that the surgeon or the innovator has to be extremely honest with himself and stick to the ethics of the situation. But without them, the progress would be horribly slow. The things that we develop by ourselves with our own hands are just ideas. They can take them to the next step. And to not work with industry is as wrong as overdoing it with them. So we have to find a balance. We constantly have to be honest with ourselves and have to shoot for high moral and ethical behavior.
So I want to dig a little bit further into that, Jeff, because as you well know, there's the, and for those who don't know about it, there's something called the Sunshine Act in America, whereby companies that work with physicians, so basically it's income physicians are making other than their clinical practice. So it might be speaking fees, it might be fees for conducting research on a drug or a device, or it might be royalties for inventing something. That all has to be publicly disclosed, and it's almost like it's a dirty little secret. And it really isn't. I cannot think of any other circumstance where a professional doesn't get reimbursed for their time and their expertise, which is all it is. How do we, as ethical and responsible physicians, how do we change the dialogue? You know, the thing about the United States, the legal system, is a presumption of innocence. This always struck me that it's a presumption of guilt. How do we change the narrative, Jeff?
Well, I think that we have to say what's correct. I think that we have to disclose everything that we do and make it clearly transparent what the relationships are. We also have to make sure that those relationships are not unduly profitable. I think that we have to make sure that if we have a conflict of interest when we're describing something, that we disclose it ahead of time or have someone else talk about the subject. And we have to make sure that the profit motive is kept clear of the scientific motive. It's almost overboard. We have to work very hard at it, but I think it's for the public's best good.
Well, obviously, putting the patient at the center of all we do is critically important. We all understand that ethical duty. It's just in my career, which has not been as stellar as yours, but in my career, I have certainly come across, I'm struggling to think of a physician who behaved in an unethical manner in this regard. But, you know, the way it's portrayed in the press, it actually makes my teeth itch. So you've been involved in leadership positions with various societies, and to my mind, I'm rather less patient than you, there many are horribly bureaucratic. You got a lot of stuff done, Jeff, and often across party lines, if you will. So like getting surgeons and gastroenterologists to do a better job, to point in the same direction, which is to help patients. How have you done that? What's your philosophy in this regard? And why, for goodness sake, have you never run for national political office?
Well, those are two different questions. Let me just state, I'm not so diplomatic and perhaps too outspoken to run for national office, but I want to talk about working across party lines. I do believe that it's imperative to work across party lines in order to get things done. It's often extremely uncomfortable because what happens is that there are particular interests that people have that make it very uncomfortable. They're not all financial. They can be academic and they can be political interests. But to find common ways to profit, not necessarily financially, but to profit academically, for example. The best example I can think of, Jonathan, is the era of natural orifice surgery. And when that began, we actually formed committees of surgeons and gastroenterologists, sat down, broke bread together, thought of studies that we could do together, made up rules to progress for research studies, and we made rules where surgeons and gastroenterologists should work and had to work together on these initial procedures. I think that that built bridges and got people to know each other and created mutual respect. It's not easy, but you have to show people that you're willing to try and occasionally forego your own benefit for the best of the project.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, just putting patients at the center of what we do, it sort of disarms people, doesn't it? Because you can't take a high and mighty political position when someone else is saying, well, look, what's best for the patient?
Yeah, sometimes you have to agree with the opponent, even though it's not in your best interest. And an example of that might be when we discuss training guidelines for endoscopy in surgery, and the gastroenterologists were very opposed to the surgical training guidelines, feeling they were inadequate. And compromise was necessary there. The surgeons had to admit that just exposure to endoscopy was not enough for competent practice. And we had to come to some sort of agreement, and it's still not always settled, but at least we talk to each other about compromise, and that's important.
Yeah, yeah. For those of you listening who don't know Jeff's achievements, look them up. They're absolutely legion. So you mentioned natural orifice surgery. Let's get on to some specifics. Jeff, in our professional lifetime, surgery has become incredibly less invasive, and you've been one of the leaders of that revolution. And well, let's look at one example, peroral endoscopic myotomy, which has a wonderful abbreviation, POEM, peroral endoscopic myotomy. Talk to us about this approach, and for the benefit of those listening who aren't doctors, explain what it is and where it's used and what it replaces.
Well, let me, Jonathan, talk about its origin in evolution. There was a time, and I just mentioned it, when surgeons and gastroenterologists worked together with the idea of puncturing, for example, the stomach through the mouth with a scope, puncturing the stomach and working inside the abdomen to remove organs that were diseased or to do surgery inside the abdomen. That idea fired the imaginations of so many people. One of the initial problems was that the puncture of the stomach could leak and could cause peritonitis. So some people started thinking of alternative ways to make a puncture that wouldn't leak. And some very bright gastroenterologists, Jay Pasricha was one of them, and others, said, what if we made a tunnel in the esophagus under the mucosa, and we then went down to the abdominal portion, and we punctured then, and then we, when we came out, this flap would then close and wouldn't leak. Well, while they tried this in some animals and noticed that although this wasn't an easy technique, they were looking right at the esophageal muscle. And they said, well, what if we were to cut that muscle and treat achalasia in that way? And that would be an interesting approach. A surgeon in Yokohama, Haru Inoue, implemented this, and he made the tunnel in the esophagus under the mucosa. He made an esophageal small incision and made a tunnel, and he looked at the muscle and with a monopolar wire cut the muscle under direct vision and then just clipped the opening closed, and wow, it worked. And so now we had an operation that replaced an open or laparoscopic operation in the abdomen or the chest by this through-the-mouth endoscopic approach. That was called peroral endoscopic myotomy, POEM, and it was tested, and it has been performed now for over a decade and is found to be fairly equal to the other approaches. So that was the beginning of the idea of what I like to call intramural surgery. So we've operated intraluminal, and we've operated extraluminal, and now we're operating intramural. And so the intramural approach is real. We can take out little tumors that way. We've cut the pyloric muscle that way for gastroparesis, and we're doing Zenker's diverticula that way in the upper esophagus. So the approach is real, and it works, and it's an innovation that really was a combination of gastroenterologists and surgeons. Very, very productive.
Yeah. For those of you who aren't familiar with the technique, there are wonderful videos available online. So you had mentioned a little earlier, so again, for the benefit of the non-medics in the audience, intramural means within the wall. Intraluminal means inside hollow organs like the gut. And let's talk about one of those things. So surgeons have been getting ever more creative using natural orifices, the mouth, the anus and such like, to enter the body. Can you give us your views, update folks where we are with this approach? Because it's had some false starts, right?
Yeah, it's still a bit on the shelf. And the reason is that we were learning how to get into the abdomen, and we did, both through the mouth, going through the stomach, or through the rectum, going through the colon, and through the vagina to get into the abdomen. And the operations were performed successfully. But as we evaluated those techniques, we found out a few things. Number one, they were time-consuming. They were expensive, very expensive. And manipulation of the tissue was very difficult because these instruments weren't really designed for that purpose. And so when we stood back and said, is this going to be mainstream surgery? We said, no, it's really not effective to take out an appendix in 6 hours with instruments that cost many, many thousands of dollars. And so that is presently still under study. And I think that's good, because what we've learned from that is just because we can do something at the one time, it does not mean that we should continue to do it. We need to keep studying it and improving it.
Yeah, 100% agree when you said that. And a degree of introspection is necessary. And people think about innovation just being like a moment in time. And most people who are not doctors who will have heard of laparoscopy, you know, think of it coming to fruition in the late 1980s. Well, in fact, it was being done on and off for decades before. It takes time for things to stick, doesn't it? So
sometimes there's a small technological advancement, like the video camera.
Yeah.
Which took basic laparoscopy, which was one man's eye, and turned it into a way that the entire room full of people could participate. That one technological change made the difference in therapeutic laparoscopy. There's also a change, Jonathan, in the way we approach disease. Appendectomy for a century was treated by surgery, and it was very successful and still is. But we found by recent studies that many patients with appendicitis can be managed medically. And this was heresy a few decades ago, and now we actually think it's a way of treating some of these patients. So our thoughts about disease processes change as well.
Yeah, I like to reflect back on how medicine has changed even, you know, in our professional lifetime. Antibiotics would never have been thought of the way to treat a peptic ulcer. I mean, much of the work of a general surgeon was looking after patients surgically with peptic ulcer disease, until it was Barry Marshall, wasn't it, who discovered Helicobacter pylori, the bug that causes peptic ulceration, and dramatically changed the way we treated the disease, right?
It's a moving target. It's constantly evolving.
And that's why medicine is such great fun. So let's switch topics a little bit. And we've hinted at how we educate people. And I know you're involved in an online project. So let's go back. When I was at medical school, we did 18 months of anatomy and other basic sciences and undertook cadaveric dissection. We would actually do 18 months of dissection. Now it seems anatomy is almost an elective study. Are medical school graduates, the young men and women who graduate in 2022, are they the same as when you and I graduated?
I think that's a funny question, because they're not the same. They learn differently, and they have different knowledge basis than we did. For example, I hated anatomy. I hated the smell of the anatomy lab, the formalin, the dead tissue. I didn't like that. The way they learn now is they learn conceptually. They learn with 3D holographic images, etc. Then they come to the operating room and they may study the anatomy in parts rather than trying to learn it as a whole body. If they're studying the neck, they may study the anatomy of the neck when they're doing endocrine surgery and learn about it in a practical fashion that way. At the end of the day, they learn the knowledge and they seem to be very good doctors. It's just a different way of learning. We are very attached to the way we did it, but I have to say that they learn differently and they learn well. But it's painful for us sometimes to watch anatomy take a backseat to other disciplines, I have to admit.
Yeah, I went back to visit my old medical school, Liverpool, and I walked into an anatomy class and there wasn't a piece of dead tissue to be seen. It was all, you know, great big computer screens with 3D renderings and overlaying MRIs and CTs and PET scans and Lord knows what.
It's true. And the graduates today are much better at interpreting 3D imaging than I am. They can look at MR, CT, and PET scans and all of that and see things that I can't see. And that aids in their ability to take care of the patients. It's just a different world now.
Yeah, it is. So again, switching topics, the impact of the pandemic and, you know, has seen telemedicine go through the roof. And I'd love to hear what you think about telemedicine in surgical practice. You know, doctors are doing remote consultations and telepresent robotic surgery is very real and feasible. Where does it go from here? And how do we correlate paying for high-tech kit when many parts of the world, even parts of the United States, people can't get basic medical care?
I think that this is the wave of the future. I think we discovered it in a hurry because of the pandemic. But I do believe, and let me give you an example. I got a call. I was vacationing in Florida in my home there, and I got a call from my son, who's a pediatric surgeon. They happened to be doing an endoscopy on a patient who had a previous trauma and a stapling of the pylorus to exclude it, and it had never opened up, but he had a gastrojejunostomy. And I was on FaceTime with my phone with their operating room and literally talked him and his partners through the use of the endoscope retrograde through the afferent limb of the gastrojejunostomy to the back of the staple pylorus where they were able to puncture it, balloon dilate it, and open it up. And that was done with zero cost using FaceTime in an extremely innovative way. And that was the beginning. I think that things are expensive now and fancy video setups are expensive. But in the future, I think this will be the way we bring modern medicine to remote areas. And we'll have capable assistants and partners in those areas. And we'll be able to assist them via the telemedicine and guide their hands and help them. Robotics will come into it as well. But I think it's a lot of video communication that can help people.
Well, I mean, and sometimes it's not even complex stuff. My old mate, Yulin Wang, I'm going to plug the World Telehealth Initiative, a not-for-profit that Yulin set up and is being run by a lady named Sharon Allen. I've talked to Yulin on this podcast, is basically using telemedicine to bring even sometimes the most basic healthcare to parts of the world where can't get it.
I think that's absolutely true, and it's something we learned in the pandemic and we can really expand on.
Well, let's continue that theme. How do we justify the world the pandemic has taught us that we are all one species and we're all in this together? How do we justify the cost and deployment of very high-tech surgery in a world where the vast majority of people don't have any access to medical care, let alone, you know, telerobotic surgery? What position should doctors take in national and international policy on such matters, or is it none of our business?
No, it's definitely our responsibility. I've traveled to remote countries where there's no electricity, up into the mountains and taking care of patients. That's why you have to know basic real surgery, open surgery as well, and be able to perform simple operations in the way we used to do it, use local anesthetic and do suturing the way we used to, and to teach people how to do that. I think where there's no electricity, we cannot do robotic surgery. We cannot do laparoscopic surgery, but we certainly can do real surgery, open surgery, and we should be able to teach that. I think we have to first get people contributing and participating in these outreach things and do step-by-step projects. Listen, the world isn't vaccinated yet. I think 5% of Africa is vaccinated. This is a part of the problem of the world right now, but I think physicians have a responsibility to say what's right and to keep pushing that envelope further.
Yeah, absolutely right. And, you know, the World Telehealth Initiative has come about because doctors like you who traveled and, you know, I've had the privilege of doing some of that, can't travel at the moment. So the need has not gone away. And by the way, for the benefit of the audience, I just want to tell you a memory I have, Jeff. When I was staying with you once in Ohio, and you had a place outside of town, a lovely little cottage, and you told me that you had a patient who was an Amish gentleman that you'd looked after, and you asked me if I wanted to accompany you on a house call. And he went to visit this lovely old chap, and we went into his home. And I remember these folks, for those not familiar with the Amish, they don't use electricity. It's all candlelit and everything. Do you remember that?
I had several such patients, and I do remember that.
It stayed with me, I thought, because I always thought doing house calls, I used to do them, and I loved seeing patients in their home and always considered it a huge privilege.
Frankly, I think we gained more out of that than the patient did.
100%.
It was something that... the reason we went into medicine, the feeling you got in your heart and your soul was wonderful. And I remember doing such a patient, and I did a colonoscopy on such a patient. I brought her down on a weekend because she didn't have insurance, and actually took her into the hospital and did the colonoscopy. And in payment, she said, "What do I owe you?" And I said, "A plate of brownies," which was the best gift I've gotten. So
Jeff, before we wrap up, I always like to ask my guests some version of this question. So let's imagine, are you still riding, by the way?
I do. I don't ride as fast as I used to, and I don't go off the ground, but I ride down the trails and enjoy the countryside, yes.
Well, hang on a second, though. You may be getting older. The horse is not necessarily getting older.
But... my horses are getting older with me.
So let's imagine that you're out riding and your horse rears up, having seen a shiny metal lamp in a hedgerow. You dismount, you pick it up, rub the lamp, and out pops a genie who offers you 3 wishes to make the world a healthier, happier place. What would you wish for?
Well, if he gave me 4 wishes, the first thing I'd say is that I get a horse that doesn't rear.
Touche.
But I think that... it's hard to figure out what those wishes would be, but I think for equity in healthcare throughout the world would be one of them. We've alluded to that already. The cost of drugs, even in our own country, in the United States, is outrageous, with great variability from not only from city to city, but even within the city, the cost of drugs is ridiculous. I have a friend who takes a blood thinner every day. He's a wealthy guy. I said, "How much does that cost?" It cost him $500 a month. Well, a poor man couldn't afford that. And I think that equity in healthcare also includes reasonable prices for drugs and availability of those drugs. I think that those are some of the things I would work toward.
Well, having moved back to the UK, I was always amused living in America how there would be this sort of sneering contempt for the British National Health Service, which, trust me, is not without its problems. However, it's free at the point of care. And having to buy some medications here for a relative and knowing what those same drugs cost in the United States, the copay in the United States is more expensive than it costs to buy the drug here. And it is unconscionable, I agree with you. So, Professor Jeffrey Ponsky, Jeff, thanks so much for being on the podcast today and for all you do and have done for the practice of medicine and the patients you care for.
Thank you, Jonathan. I only wish I was with you to shake your hand and give you a hug.
I wish the same thing, Jeff. Hopefully soon. Hopefully soon. So, folks, I'm afraid that's it for today. Please tune in next week for another episode of the EMG Health Podcast with me, your host, Jonathan Sakia. Until then, stay safe, stay well, stay curious. Bye for now.